From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. Each week on the show, we take a particular topic or a theme. We look at it from a multiplicity of perspectives. And this week, we're talking about language. And it actually has, the idea for the show actually has a very particular moment of genesis. We were out for dinner last week.
You and I were there together. We were with a visiting writer at Colorado College, sitting at the restaurant.
Exactly. We were at the restaurant, and we could see across the restaurant, we could see our order sitting there. And our friend said, I wish there was some word to describe the particular feeling of helplessness and rage that descends upon you when you are at a restaurant. You can see your order, but you know you cannot get it.
Right. And so there are things that we all have felt that feeling, but why doesn't English have a word for it, a special word for something we experience?
The place to begin in trying to answer the question of why don't we have a word for that is asking what kind of a thing is the English language to begin with? Where does it come from? How did it start?
England starts out with indigenous Celtic languages, some form of proto-Celtic.
That's Ray Evett, Associate Dean of Colorado College.
And Professor of English.
But there are various groups of people who visit, conquer, you know, invade, and the language develops over the period of 1,500 years, really, to what it is today, based on these various invasions.
So it has to do with conquest.
It has to do with conquest. The development of English is driven by conquest initially. You have the Romans who come in 43 CE, and they establish Latin as the language of politics and eventually religion on the continent. And so right from the very earliest records of language in England that we have, you have a multilingual society. And the indigenous Celtic then, you know, they come eye to eye with Angles and with Danes and with Vikings over the course of time. Once the Romans leave in around 400, I think it's 410 that they leave, then it's a free-for-all. It's a wild space for anybody to come and visit England and to establish a foothold. And many of the people who come in conquest actually don't come and leave. They come and stay. And so you have the indigenous peoples. You have intermarriage. You have all sorts of things going on that shapes the language.
So does it catch on like in 400? Or how long does it take? What's the timeline like?
What is it?
English.
Does English catch on? Well, okay. So you have there are a couple of different things going on. But you have the initial invasions of the Angles and the Jutes around 449. And then at the end of the 700s, you have the Danes, at the end of the 700s, you have the Vikings, and then you have the Danes coming in at the end of the 800s. Okay, so you already have a period there after the Romans leave of around 400 years, where you have three different sets of invasions.
And so English is the product of those successive invasions, these people coming in, taking over, getting taken over, leaving, and the language emerges from that?
Leaving or staying and deciding to make a home there. And so their language and whatever kind of Celtic is being spoken in England at the time, those two languages merging. You see it in the place names. There are a bunch of really interesting spaces where you can clearly mark places that were Celtic villages because you still see the Celtic roots in the English words used to describe the place names now. At that point, English has been, you know, Latin and Celtic or Latin and Celtic and these other Germanic languages. And that's produced Anglo-Saxon or Old English, what we know Beowulf to be written in. And then around 1066, you have the Norman conquest. And that brings a French-speaking group of Anglo-Normans to England who are then using their French as the language of governance.
Sort of what Latin was before.
Yes, they take over. And Latin has become by this time the language of the church. So you have French being spoken in politics and by the royalty. You have Latin being spoken by the church and for any kind of legal record. And you have Anglo-Saxon, which is gradually being influenced by French and turning into Middle English as a result, Chaucer's English, you have that language developing over the period of the 300 years where you have basically a triglossic situation where you have the three languages.
Triglossic situation. So do we know what English sounded like before the Normans got there?
We do. We think we do, but you know, all of it is it's a retrofitted. It's a construction of the past. It's a reconstruction of the past.
So can you speak it?
Can I?
Can you give us an example?
I can read you Cædmon's Hymn, which is a beautiful little short lyrical poem.
All right. So what's the basic story behind Cædmon's Hymn?
Cædmon is a sheepherd, a lowly sheepherd, and he is participating in a big feast in a hall, one of these huge Anglo-Saxon halls,
right,
straight out of Beowulf, and people are entertaining themselves with poetry and sung poetry. And they're passing the harp, and everyone gets a turn, and they have to sing. And Cædmon realizes that he has nothing to sing. He thinks he's a lowly herdsman, and he runs away. He exits the hall and gives up his chance at a fine meal and goes to the cowshed and falls asleep there feeling a little crummy about himself for not being able to produce
poetry. Well,
that's
what I do. When I'm feeling down, that's the first place I go.
The cowshed.
To the cowshed.
And so he's there, and he has a dream. A wisdom figure comes to him in this dream and says, Cædmon, sing of the creation.
All right. So this is English before the French influence. This is English pre 1066.
Yeah, this is English. The manuscripts that we have that have this poem date from 658 through roughly 680. So it's way back, right?
Okay, let's.
Nu scholon herian hervon riches werd, methodes machta and his mode jethank, werk wulder fader, swa he wundre jehuas, eche drichten or on stelde. He eris chop erthan bernum, heofon to hrofe. Harlig shippened, the midden yard mon kunes werd, eche drichten, after Theode, firum foldon, Freya elmichtig.
It sounds almost German to me.
It is German.
Is it?
It's Germanic.
Yeah.
You know, Anglo-Saxon is Germanic. Anglo-Saxon is English before the French invaded. But, you know, it's the language itself is, it becomes something entirely different. It sounds different. It looks different. You can do different things with it. Different kinds of poetry emerge as a result. The poem I just read you is, you know, it's an example of alliterative poetry without end rhyme. And suddenly you have the possibility of, you know, continental influences in poetry. Chaucer makes a big go of that. His contemporary John Gower is writing poetry in Latin, French, and English. But Chaucer is relying entirely on English for a body of work. He does some translating from Latin into Middle English, but his body of work is in Middle English, and he makes that the language of poetry.
All right. So what does Chaucer's English sound like? This vernacular that is going to can you give us a little bit of what that sounds like?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the opening of the Canterbury Tales, which is, you know, famous and probably worth reciting here. It is the one piece of poetry that I find people know all over the place in Middle English all the time. So, okay. One that April with his sure assault the drucht of March hath pierced to the road and bathed every vein in switch liqueur of which vertu engendered is the flour. One Zephyrus ache with his sweet breath inspired hath in every holt and heath the tender cropus, and the younger son hath in the ram his half a course irona, and small fools mark and melodia that sleepen all the nicht with open ear. So pricketh him nature in here courageous. Then longen folk to gone on pilgrimages and palmers for forsaken, strange strondes to ferne hallowes couth in sundry londes, and specially from every shear's end of England to Canterbury they wend.
Of England to Canterbury they wend.
Yeah. And of course, the last two bits of that,
yeah.
The holy blissful martyr for to sake, that him hath holpen one that they were sake. It is a pilgrimage, and they are seeking Thomas of Becket.
So
in Canterbury.
When you listen to that, you can make out words, essentially. It's essentially a similar language, is it?
Yeah. think it's similar. It sounds very similar to me. But I think I come at languages from a weird space of having grown up in a bilingual household myself. So it's a shadow language to English, to modern English. One of the things that happens with the English language is that after there's all of this, there's a period of 1,000 years of conquest and changing the language on the island. Of course, then England has, its colonial period, and it begins to expand into the world. And so English meets other languages, whereas other languages have been coming to the island and shaping English for a period of 1,000 to 1,500 years. Then you have English going out and meeting other languages and taking on the characteristics of the other languages. We were talking about conquest earlier, but it's the history of conquest and expansion. So all sorts of things begin to shape the development of the language. And it's not just who speaks it, but where you speak it and who you're speaking it to and who you're trying to teach the language to and how much they bring of their own language into their speaking of the language. So there are lots of wild, fresh, new dialects happening all the time as English moves out into the world, just because it takes on the characteristics of other voices, other cultures, other ethnicities. So it's I think that's interesting about it.
Over the last 500-600 years, what we've been seeing is English really hitting the road.
Absolutely.
And changing as a result of its travels.
Absolutely. You see that in Chaucer's poetry. He went as a diplomat to Italy and may have even had conversations with Boccaccio and
wow.
With Petrarch. And so it's one of those weird shifts where the Renaissance is happening in Italy, even though it's not happening in England. England is decidedly medieval at the time. And Chaucer's bringing back Renaissance culture to England. So that kind of cultural exchange happens when English becomes colonial, when people begin to show up in America and then expand across the West.
That was Ray Evett, Associate Dean of Colorado College and Professor of English, and really showing us a striking example of the way that language changes over, when you think about the history of human life, over a relatively short period, actually.
This linguistic history is something you want to keep in mind when you're trying to invent a word.
And even more so if you're doing something more complex, like inventing an entirely new language.
Which is exactly what David Peterson did. He's a trained linguist who's invented many languages for science fiction shows and, most recently, Game of Thrones. David Peterson is the guy who invented the Dothraki language. I want to know, how do you go about making up a language from scratch?
For me, it usually starts with an idea. For me, often it's either a grammatical idea, a phonological idea, or a morphological idea, something that I think is neat, some sort of a system that I'd like to implement and put into practice in some way.
Can you give us an example?
For example, a language like Arabic makes use of something called the triconsonantal root system, where how words are related and derived from one another and relate to one another is different phonological elements are surrounded about a series of consecutive consonants that always appear in the same order. So the word for book in Arabic is kitab. The plural of that is kutub. It's still KTB in order. That's what all these words have. To write is kataba, and so like I write is aktub, he writes is yaktub. And so once you know how that works in Arabic, it becomes a really attractive idea to try to create a language to do that. That actually happened to be the system I used for my very first language. But I gave it another whirl in a language I'm doing for a show on the CW called Starcrossed. Because I wanted to do a better job with it. Anyway, so you start out with this idea, and then usually the way that I proceed, different language creators will do it in different orders. But I start with the sounds and get that to a certain point of stability. Then I move on to morphology, inflectional morphology, so how nouns change based on number or where they are in the sentence. And then verbal morphology, how verbs conjugate, what they conjugate for, what they agree with. You come up with a lot of really neat ideas in morphology. and think, oh, this will be absolutely great. Oh, sentences will work this way. And then you actually sit down and try to translate a short text, usually something like the Babel text, the Tower of Babel text, or the North Wind and the Sun. And you realize, oh, all of these neat things that I created aren't actually factoring into the language at all. And furthermore, this thing which I created, which I just created on the spur of the moment, is turning out to be very, very important. And so that triggers another round of revision. And then finally, after you've done this for a bit, you get to a point where you can really start adding words to the lexicon and start building that out, which is a really different process, which then, you know, pretty much takes the rest of your life or however long you want to spend on it.
So even in the most controlled laboratory-like conditions, language shifts. A language that you've made up changes just by virtue of the kind of thing that language is.
Yeah, and it's usually that kind of unpredictability comes once you add the human element, which, I mean, no matter how much you foreplan when you're sitting down and designing these things, the human element comes with translation, where it's just you. Once you actually are tasked with that, you say, well, I have to render this into this language. It just changes things to a significant extent as you start to say, well, these are the tools I have. How am I going to employ these? It's not as if you have a fixed idea for everything in a language and exactly how it's supposed to work and how it's going to work. Things will do what they do. And that's part of the reason that languages change over time. People start using things in unpredictable ways, in ways that people in the past didn't use them, and in ways that just make sense to them, which isn't necessarily what made sense to previous generations.
How does it work in terms of the intentional introduction of irregularity into a language?
So a created language like Esperanto was created specifically to try to eradicate irregularity from the language because they thought, you know, irregularities are difficult and they're hard to learn, and so a perfect language should have none of them. Esperanto failed at this, but, you know, it's still a fun language. Coming from it from the naturalist perspective, which is what I do, all natural languages have irregularities. You can't find one that doesn't have it. And irregularities are actually functional. There's a reason that they're still there in English. So within a language, what you do is you start off with this semi-regular pattern, and then you evolve it to such a point that suddenly it looks irregular because there's a new regular pattern that's emerged that has been applied to all of the non-frequent words. So like the new words will always take, like, let's say the new plural, and it's only a set of the most frequently used words that retain the old plural, which used to be regular. And so to replicate that in a natural language, what you have to do is basically evolve a language. Start at an early point, create a system, evolve it, change the sounds, you know, really take a bat to it, and then produce something that at the state or at the time period that you're working with looks a lot more like a natural language than, you know, something like Esperanto was trying to do.
What about the dream of Esperanto, the global language that was going to be for all people? It didn't catch on.
Right.
Is that a dream that we've stopped having?
Esperanto wanted very much to be the universal, the default universal auxiliary language. So not everybody's first language, but everybody's second language. The idea being that if everybody spoke the same language, there would be, there'd be no more conflict. That a lot of conflict was based in the fact that people spoke different languages, and you can see how this is this was a European that came up with this idea. It was really the world wars that I think killed off the artificial language movement. But if you step back from that goal and look at Esperanto just as a created language, and you look at created language success as number of speakers, Esperanto remains the most successful and most popular created language of all time. Probably about 1 million people actively use Esperanto, many not because they have any hopes for it supplanting natural languages, but because they just like it. They find it fun. And they enjoy the community that's grown up around it. In fact, if you go the world over, there are a number of people whose first languages is Esperanto. It's always the children of Esperantists, and usually the children of Esperantists who don't speak the same language, because people go to these international Esperanto conventions, they meet, and one thing leads to another, but then they discover that, like, you know, one is a Russian speaker and one is a Korean speaker, and the only language they share is Esperanto. So obviously when they have children, they speak the only language they share. Ami estas stari, mano en mane,
antaŭ la vivo. That was Game of Thrones language creator David Peterson, the architect of the Dothraki language.
So it seems that one of the things in creating a language is really having that language tied to the particulars of a culture. That language is something that is an expression really of something of the culture of a group.
Absolutely. And that's particularly the case with the Dothraki language that Peterson invented. There's all kinds of things that the Dothraki can and cannot say. There's no word for please. There's no word for thank you, because they are a warrior-like people who simply take everything.
Right. So, for example, the culture where I spend a lot of my time in Polynesia, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of words for the concept of love, really minute distinctions about the type of love you're talking about, whether it's the love that you would have for a partner as opposed to the love for your child as opposed to a love for a friend. It's something that that culture really values and explores through language.
Well, I think that's one version of it, where language is a way of organizing experience. But what about the actual physical pronunciation of a language? In what way are the things that we can and cannot say constitutive of who we are and what group we belong to?
Because although language can draw us together as a group, it also provides a separation, an us versus them. This is Professor William Davis in the Comparative Literature Department at Colorado College discussing the ways in which a single word can be a marker for who is us and who is them.
Shibboleth is a term, comes from the Old Testament, from Hebrew, and then it's come to mean a word that can only be correctly pronounced by native speakers of that language, and therefore can be used as sort of a test to see if someone is a native member of that language community or not. So the shibboleth meaning that some language groups can't say "tha," for example, as in shibboleth. And so if you ask them to say it and they say it incorrectly, then you know they're enemies, perhaps in disguise.
All right, so then it's like, it was a password used by the Hebrews, is that right?
Yes, yes. And also, I mean, the word comes up a lot. I mean, Derrida has written about it. It comes up a lot. But my understanding is it was also used by American soldiers in the South Pacific fighting the Japanese in World War II, that the word Lollapalooza was used as a shibboleth.
So the word that was the word.
Yes. So on a guard post, they would require someone to say Lollapalooza, and if anything that came out that sounded like Rarapalooza, they would just shoot you.
So, and that's because of the because the Japanese soldiers
had trouble saying la la, right? Because la la sound doesn't exist in Japanese.
So, in terms of as somebody who teaches language, as somebody you're a professor of comparative literature, you also teach a lot of German, and
yes.
And I wonder, does that happen a lot that you run into these shibboleth-like things? You're teaching German, and there's just some sounds that a certain population can't pronounce.
Sure. There are plenty of sounds that from one language to another are difficult to pronounce. I mean, it's usually not difficult if you think about yourself as a native speaker of North American English. It's not hard to tell someone who has an accent that's different who is not a native speaker. And often you don't think of a specific sound or something like that. But if you're – it's just the overall effect of the – it could be the rhythm, it could be the tone and various sounds. But yes, every language has things like that that are difficult for non-native speakers to pronounce, depending on what age they learned the language and all that. But there are certainly ones in German that people often joke about that say English speakers can't say very well. One is the German word for squirrel, for example.
The German English speakers. So what is that?
Have trouble saying Eichhörnchen.
Eichhörnchen.
Well, that's, you know, not too bad.
I wonder if that's like a shibboleth. So if somebody, you can't say squirrel, then immediately you get stabbed in the back.
Yeah, sort of. You have to say Eichhörnchen. Well, yeah, it's just because the CH sound and the O umlaut that's in there are, there's a consonant and a vowel sound that we don't have in English. And there aren't that many, actually, in German that we don't have in English, but there are a few consonant and vowel sounds we just don't have. You know, people ask me about, well, how can there be beautiful poetry in German or something like that? And I find that's an absurd and naive question.
Ridiculous thing to say.
Just as if there could, you know, could there be beautiful poetry in Chinese because I don't understand the language. Mm-hmm. But with German, I often think, you know, I've thought about that comparison. There are sounds that seem, as it were, harsh to English speakers. I mean, you could equally ask the same thing about English. How could there be beautiful poetry in English? It's such a weird conglomerate language. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned earlier, there are only a couple of sounds in German we don't have in English. One of them are two different CH sounds. One's like a ich, ja, and there's a ach. This is the back of your throat more.
Ach.
Yeah, although, yeah, that's good. Although French has that too, like in rouge.
Yeah.
You know, rah. Anyway, and then there are a couple of, you know, those are the sounds that I think English speakers code as most harsh. Like, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach, it's at the back of your throat. But which sounds harsher to you, Steve? Ich liebe Johann Sebastian Bach or Betty Crocker baked a motherfucking cake.
Yikes!
Any language can sound harsh depending on, you know, your perspective.
Well, I will never think of Betty Crocker and her mother.
I just said the ka 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 sound is one in English that we have that's also harsh, if you will.
Is there the cognitive equivalent of that? Is there a thought or a way of thinking that's more, you know, say readily apparent in English than in German or in French? The way in which our linguistic orientation changes the way we our thought process. What's your thought about that?
Well, you know, it's hard. That's kind of a chicken and egg problem. It's hard to say right off whether a language changes culture or culture changes language or both. Certainly, I think there are expressions and things that we might have in a language that reflects some aspect of its culture you just don't have in another language. And those are difficulties in translation of novels or poems and that sort of thing. You know, in Greece, for example, modern Greek is an important word, pareia, which means something like, which we don't have an exact word for as far as I know in English. It's something like your group of friends, your gang, you know, your crowd that you hang out with. But, my gang, you know, my group of friends. But that reflects something about the social nature of Greek culture, I think, too, that people don't go out to dinner alone. They always have a group of friends around them. It's very social. Right. It's very – not that, you know, other cultures aren't also. But we don't have – I can't think of in modern English an exact equivalent without using several different terms to try to describe it. I mean, that's just one little example, and I'm sure every language has those. And if you're going to translate that word in a novel or something, you'd have to find some way to express it, you know, with group or crowd or gang or something like that. But those all resonate in different ways.
Do you think there are cultural shibboleths in terms of the pronunciation of words that give away, you know, that you're not part of an in-group? Like the one that springs to my mind is to comment on the timbre of music.
Mm-hmm.
If you say timbre of an instrument, if you say timber, everyone
who would say that
exactly everyone you it's a dead giveaway that you're not, you know, in the know.
Yes, I think I think that's an interesting point. And if you think just about our own contemporary culture, in your own life, you have various subgroups with whom you speak differently. I mean, if you're a member of a certain religion, there are certain ways of saying things that other outsiders, even if they may have studied the religion, they don't know it from the inside, will probably get wrong and indicate to you, obviously, that they're new or outsiders. Or even the term like newbie we use online,
yeah.
That's to suggest somebody who's not really familiar with the jargon. You know, whether you're talking about computers, sports, I mean, people who are really into rock climbing can immediately tell in conversation if somebody really is familiar with the equipment and the terms that are used. Same with golf. I mean, any sport is a good example. But on all sorts of other ways, the way in which you talk, say things about where you're from, your demographic, even your politics, I would think, and religion, things like that. These are parts, and even if you don't think about them consciously, obviously they are parts of your identity, and they are indicators to others, just as things like clothing are. I think that would be another physical example of a shibboleth like that. You know, in Europe, it's often easy to tell Americans just because of how poorly they dress, you know, or the way they dress, let's put it that way.
That was William Davis, professor of comparative literature at Colorado College.
This is Off Topic. It's a language episode. Stay with us.
And after all, we're only ordinary men.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. Each week, we take a subject, we take a question, we lay it out on the examination table, we dissect it, we look at it under the light. This week, it's language.
You know, we've been talking about the way language develops, its roots, its origins, how it changes over time, how it has changed over time. But I don't want us to pretend that language isn't still developing here in the 21st century. And I'm thinking about my kids and the things they say. So they'll say things like really out loud, say LOL or JK.
What, JK? They say JK.
They say JK.
So what does that mean?
Just kidding. Just kidding. JK, Mom.
And so you can feel that technological, that abbreviation, that textual abbreviation seeping in and changing your vocabulary?
Right. It's really like text speak has become a part of the vocabulary of the generation that's coming up now. Technology really changes the way people speak.
How they speak and the way they write and what they write. A perfect example of this is the typewriter. Darren Wishler is the author of The Iron Whim, a book which traces the impact that typewriters have had on language and on, most particularly, literature.
I started thinking about typewriters more or less when I started thinking about my own computer. And at first of all, it started out as a kind of meditation on keyboards, and I was thinking a lot about keyboards. And it occurred to me fairly quickly that there's a massive difference between a computer keyboard and a typewriter keyboard. They look the same, but they do very different things.
You know? How so? How so? In what way?
Well, a typewriter is all about cause and effect. There's this kind of cold mechanical logic to it. You hit a key, you watch a couple of levers move, a hammer comes down on a ribbon and it leaves a mark on paper. It's cause and effect, and you can follow that chain all the way through it. You hit a key on your computer, you have absolutely no idea what you're going to get. You might get a letter. It might move your little on-screen avatar slightly to the left. It might increase the volume on your computer. It could send an email. All kinds of other preposterous things can happen as well. You know, there's no direct and visible logic with a computer. And I think this is partly why we currently have a kind of nostalgia for mechanical devices like typewriters, is because we can use them as a kind of metaphor to explain computers to ourselves, because what goes on inside your computer is going far too fast for you to follow, millions of instructions a second. And it's happening on a scale that's far, far below the level of human observation. So you can't see it. So we need a metaphor. We need some sort of way to explain it to ourselves. So things like steampunk or Rube Goldberg machines or, you know, Coke ads where you can see the kind of the world of strange machines and odd creatures that lives inside the Coke machine once you drop your quarter inside. All of those sorts of things are metaphors that we use to explain the digital to us. But they're all mechanical metaphors because we understand that, or at least we think we do.
Right. So then the typewriter, in effect, is a metaphor for the computer.
Well, now it is. I mean, it's what the typewriter meant was different before computers because its relationship to how we wrote was completely different. I think that the idea that, you know, that your thoughts pre-exist the writing of them just doesn't really work. The typewriter or any other technology that you happen to be using actively contributes to the production of those ideas. Nietzsche knew this, and he started thinking about it when he got his first typewriter, and he said, like, you can read the aphorisms that Nietzsche wrote on his typewriter, and they say things like, you know, as we use our tools, they also work on us. So he was, you know, he was acutely aware of this, that the typewriter played a role in the production of what he wrote.
Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which the typewriter specifically works on the writers who used it predominantly, and maybe also the language generally?
Yeah. Well, there are these kinds of subtle transformations that take place when people type. I looked at this very carefully when I wrote my book about typewriting, The Iron Whim. And what I found over and over again is that if you look at what authors say about their typewriters, overwhelmingly, there is this sense that something is coming through the typewriter, that it's flowing through the typewriter to them, that their ideas don't originate with them. And in some ways, this is just a kind of mechanization of the notion of, you know, inspiration from the muses. But it starts to take these weird modern forms, like William Burroughs talking about, you know, the remote control bug aliens that are, you know, dictating text to him and so on and so forth. So again, it doesn't matter what the metaphor is, but if you look at how it works, it's pretty clear that writers have a very different sense of what they're doing when they're using a typewriter than when they're using a pen. And again, the metaphors all change when we start using computers.
I don't know. I think, you know, I don't know if I ever, like, you know, identified the typewriter as being this antennae, this antenna that brought things into the... But I certainly, like, I thought the harder I could hit the keys, the better. You know, I had some kind of feeling like I type harder when I mean it or when I get into it.
And again, like, if you look at what poets have said about typewriters, there's often that sense as well, that the typewriter somehow conveys the intent of the writer. Charles Olson talked about this at length in his work on projective verse, and Marshall McLuhan cribbed most of it for his chapter on typewriting in Understanding Media.
Sure.
So writers have talked about the typewriter as the equivalent of the stave and bar of a musical composer, you know, and we have reams and reams of typewriter music kicking around as testament to that. The most famous of those is Leroy Anderson's piece, The Typewriter, but I'm sort of partial to the very first bootleg recording of Janis Joplin in her house is this thing called the typewriter tapes, because she's sitting there singing Trouble in Mind, and at some point someone comes into the room behind her and starts to accompany her percussively on the typewriter. So, you know, it's a minor musical history, but there is a history of thinking about the typewriter as a kind of, you know, percussive instrument that relates to the production of music or poetry.
Can you you think of any like a quick anecdote about a author whose work differs substantially because of the medium that they're writing under?
I would argue basically every writer is an example of that to some degree. You know, so one of the famous ones, of course, is Kerouac,
right?
Like writing on the road, and when he was trying to come up with a means to capture what he thought of as this new authentic American language, he came up with this very peculiar combination of things. Kerouac was an incredibly fast typist to start with, but he wanted a way to be able to continue to type without having to stop for anything, without having to stop to change paper or so on and so forth. And on a computer, of course, this wouldn't be a problem.
You can
type and type and type as long as you have power. But what he did was he taped a whole bunch of sheets of paper together into a single long scroll. And on top of that, took a whole bunch of coffee and Benzedrine. He was a fairly serious enthusiast of Benzedrine. He'd take the little strips out of nasal inhalers and drop them into his coffee cup. So so Jack Kerouac hopped up on speed and coffee, could type as fast as he could go, and as fast as his mind was sort of racing along without ever having to stop. So you could argue that what he did was he built himself a very specific kind of machine to capture a very specific kind of writing. But you could say that about anybody. You could think about Proust in his, cork-lined room, kneeling on the floor in the darkness with seven or eight different pieces of paper in front of himself, again, ingesting all kinds of odd drugs and scribbling away. That's a kind of machine for the production of text. Writing on a computer is a similar sort of thing. But writers are continually coming up with these odd gimcrack systems that enable them to write in a very specific kind of way that suits their personalities.
That was Darren Wishler. He's professor of communications at Concordia University in Montreal. He's the author of The Iron Whim and The Apostrophe Project. You're listening to Off Topic. It's a language episode. Stay with us. This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. It's the language episode. We've been talking about how technology changes what we write and how we speak. Go.
I
thought you were going to go into something. You said you had somewhere to go.
Oh, okay. We've been talking. I thought you'd keep that in how we write and how we speak. One of the things that poets have always been acutely conscious of is the degree to which language is a constraint, that the things that we can say are determined in advance of our arriving at or in the language. The language has a limited ability to say or not say certain kinds of things. It's a system that's set up in a particular way.
But that's, I think, part of the project of literature is to take those tools we have available to us and stretch them, use them, find new things that we can express through an innovative use of language.
There's another way of thinking about the kind of innovation that poetic expression can bring about, which has not to do with linguistic freedom, which is what we normally equate artistic production with, but with the opposite, with the embrace of constraints, with limiting the options in language. And for some poets, narrowing the field of expression can be the ways to other forms of expression. That's exactly the case in the work of Christian Book, author of Eunoia, who narrows his linguistic options in order to say something startling and I think really new.
My name is Christian Book. I'm an experimental poet in Canada. I'm probably most notorious for having written a book entitled Eunoia, spelled E-U-N-O-I-A. The book consists of five chapters, each of which tells a story, but does so using only one of the five vowels. So in the first chapter, the only vowel that appears is the letter A. In the second chapter, the only vowel that appears is the letter E, etc.
Chapter A, for Hans Arp. Awkward grammar appalls a craftsman. Adada bard as daft as Zara dams stagnant art and scrawls an alpha, a slapdash arc and a backward zag that mars all stanzas and jams all ballads. What a scandal.
Eunoia is a virtuoso performance. It's also the product of an amazing amount, a voluminous amount of research.
The project entailed that I entailed me reading the Third Webster's New International three-volume dictionary 5 times.
So I wanted to know what Christian had learned about the English language through this process of putting together this extraordinary volume of poetry.
The things that I learned about the language are interesting. I discovered that each of the vowels seems to have its own emotional register, its own personality, that the kinds of vocabulary generated, say, by using only the letter A or the letter E are radically different from those words that contain only O or only U. And as a consequence, each of the chapters has its own unique discursive register, you know, its own tone.
So if I'm following you, there's something A-like about the chapter A. What is that emotional tone?
Well, I think the letters A and E are often lyrical and elegiac in tone, whereas the language in O and U, for example, are jocular and obscene.
Helen remembers Crete, the Eden where senescent shepherds, les bergers des bêtes, herd bellwether sheep. There Helen sees the pebbled steps, the eskers where church on how to do so. Folks too cool to go to sock hops, go to Woodstock rock shows to do pot, not to foxtrot to Motown rondos of pop, bop, or doo-wop. Congo bongos throb to voodoo hoodoo, tom-toms for powwows go boom, boom, thud. Scum plus crud plugs up ducks, thus ubu must flush such sulcus ruts. Sump pumps pump, chuff, chuff.
You know, the other thing I learned, of course, is that it's possible to speak intelligibly and say things of literary merit. I assumed that it would be very challenging to say anything intelligible, and sure enough it was. But despite these very rigorous duresses, language demonstrated that it was resilient enough to accommodate it. That in some sense, you know, I learned that censorship of the language is impossible simply by imposing rules upon it. That language is flexible or elastic enough to do kinds of amazing things when subjected to these acrobatic constraints.
So this is really an avant-garde piece of literature, really pushing the boundaries of poetry.
And one of the questions that that raises in the 21st century is, what are the boundaries? Where is he going? How can you be a poet who addresses the present of the 21st century?
I aspire to be a 21st century poet. I'm really trying to be at the cutting edge of my discipline. And after I finished Junoia, I embarked upon a really crazy project, thinking that I had permission to do so now. And it involves writing a very short poem that, through a process of encipherment, I would translate into a sequence of genetic nucleotides. And then with the assistance of a laboratory, I would actually build that gene and implant it into the genome of a bacterium, replacing part of its genetic code with my text, so that the organism would in fact become the living embodiment of my poem. Moreover, I'd write the poem in such a way that the organism would actually read that gene sequence and interpret it, and in response it would build a protein, which according to my original chemical alphabet, would itself be yet another completely intelligible poem. So in effect, I'm trying to engineer a bacterium so that it becomes not only an archive for storing my poem, but it also becomes a machine for writing a poem in response. And the punchline to this project is that the proposed host for this poem is an unkillable bacterium capable of surviving in all kinds of hostile environments. You can scorch it, freeze it, wither it, and it doesn't die. It is capable of repairing its own DNA so quickly that it does not mutate or evolve. It can survive in the open vacuum of outer space. It can even survive 1,000 times the dosage of gamma rays that would instantly kill a human being. And for this reason, it's widely regarded as one of the most durable organisms on the planet. By putting a poem into it, by storing information in its genome, I could be writing a book that might outlast terrestrial civilization, and I hope it might persist on the planet until the very moment when the sun explodes. I'm trying to write a book that lasts forever.
Christian really understands the responsibility of the poet to intersect with and to use those different disciplines, with poetry, with mathematics, and to use those quadrants of the language which are normally understood to be outside of poetry, to bring them in and to think about how they can be used to create new art.
I'm always kind of dismayed that people are not thinking more largely in their imaginative potential, you know, given especially that we're going through enormous technological changes and socioeconomic changes at the moment, it would seem to me that poetry should be able to respond very intelligibly to it. I'm, for example, dismayed that poetry does not address very well the entire discourse of science, which is probably now the most important cultural activity of the human species, and yet poetry seems ill-equipped to be able to talk about it authoritatively, or at least to incorporate it into its own practice aesthetically. And yet, you know, we live in a kind of sci-fi future now in which science has a tremendous impact upon our lives. I mean, I tell my students that, you know, that I think the literacy outside the purview of literature is important, and that I'm amazed that there is no invested interest in science. I mean, if I ask them, what is your favorite poem, canonical poem about the moon landing, they cannot name one. And, of course, they can't name one because one doesn't exist, even though, you know, that's probably the greatest epic achievement of the species, you know, to put a person on an extraterrestrial world. There is no, you know, great epic poem about it. Whereas if the ancient Greeks had rowed a trireme to the moon, you can bet there would have been a 12-volume epic narrative about that scenario. And I find that very surprising that the poetry somehow has not at least accommodated itself to its own social circumstances.
That was Christian Book, professor of English at the University of Calgary. He's the author of Eunoia and Crystallography. This is Off Topic. It's a language episode.
Stay with us.
Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward. I'll stop. I can't help it. If I'm walking down the street, if I'm exiting McDonald's, buying watermelons at Walmart, skiing, water skiing, if someone yells out, "Hey you, stop," I do exactly that. I stop. I can't help thinking that I'm the you who's supposed to stop. I bet you the same. Yeah, you. Listening to the radio. You. As a professor of English, I feel it's my duty to point out that these little nothing words that say everything and nothing about us, I, you, me, us, are called shifters. They're called that because they shift. They flip from one person to another. I is in the eye of the beholder. The same is true of our names, Steve and Kathy, Ishmael and Amitava, Dweezil and Miley. Their sounds pinned onto us and nothing more. As Gertrude Stein said, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. That was her way of pointing out the random emptiness of language, the strange way in which there's nothing about the word rose that ties it to an actual rose. Just as there's nothing about Steve that ties that sound to me. The same goes for this insipid, nasal, lisping voice of mine. Inside my head, my voice sounds completely different. It sounds like Banksy's voice in Exit Through the Gift Shop, like the voice of somebody who's testifying against the mob and whose voice has been altered to protect his identity. I'll wake up thinking of pancakes, wishing that there were some pancakes around for me to eat. And inside my head, I'll hear,
"Man, I could really go for some pancakes now."
This desire, that at the bottom of it all, I'm somehow someone else, was what made me do what I did last week when classes began at Colorado College. I was standing at a chalkboard with a broken piece of chalk in my hand. We begin with Plato's Symposium, I was saying, and then the door was kicked open and the man walked in. You the guy, he asked. The man had on dark sunglasses and a backpack.
You are not the guy,
said the voice inside my head.
Don't say you're the guy. Do not even think about it.
Yeah, I said. I'm the guy. Okay, good, he said. He seemed relieved. In one of his hands, he had a long green balloon, the kind of balloon a clown might screw up into the shape of a tiny dog or maybe a rabbit. Let's go do the thing, he said. The voice inside my head said not to follow him, that following him might be one of the worst ideas I've ever had in my life.
Quite possibly. You've never had a worser idea in your life.
Worser?
Wondered a second voice inside my head. The second voice sounded, for some reason, like one of the chipmunks.
Did you actually say worser?
What are you waiting for? Asked the man. Then he stopped and looked at me. How do I know you're the guy? How do you know I'm the guy? I said. Who do you think the guy is? The guy turned to the class. Is he the guy? There was then a long moment of silence. As a professor, I'm accustomed to such silent intervals. To be standing in front of a classroom, waiting for a student, any student, to say something. Just tell me, he shouted. If you don't tell me, you will all be in serious trouble. A girl in the front row put up her hand immediately. Yes, she told him. He's the guy. Another kid, a tall boy at the back of the classroom, put up his hand. He is so totally the guy, said the other kid near the back of the room. Even if they say you're the guy, said the man, I don't know if you are the guy. I mean, you sound like an English professor. You sound like an English professor, I retorted. If you're the guy, he said back, what happened to the guy teaching this class? I didn't have anything to say to that. I think we may have a real problem, said the man in a petulant, growling sort of way. And though he seemed to be about to say more, it was at that moment his cell phone rang, and then he was on the phone. Yeah, he said. Yeah, 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 yeah. Then he hung up. It's off, he announced. How can it be off, I asked. What are they going to say? They, he said. What about us? Then he turned to leave. Next time, he said. If there is a next time. Dude, said the student in the back, that was sick. He means sick in a good way, explained the girl in the front, the one who had been the first to say that I was the guy. At least I'm pretty sure that's what he means. I nodded then and turned back to the blackboard, on which I'd written the words Plato and Symposium. Part of me was relieved the man was gone, and part of me wanted him to come back. Part of me thought I should talk about Plato, and part of me told me I should give everyone the day off.
Go ahead,
said the voice inside my head.
Exit through the gift shop.
Class dismissed, I told them. See you next time. Read the Plato. Watch the words, all of them, but the shifters mostly. The me's and the you's, the we's and the they's. The words that say everything about us and nothing at all at the same time.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
For more information or to download any of our episodes, to download any part of this episode that you might have missed, you can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.